Welcome to ICTJ's podcast series. In the case against Thomas Lubanga, the International Criminal Court, or ICC, may for the first time award reparations to victims of crimes covered by the Rome Statute. ICTJ is one of several organizations who submitted recommendations to the ICC as it deliberates on this decision. Today we are speaking with Ruben Carranza, director of ICTJ's reparations program, about the submission and the potential impact of such a ruling. Thanks for joining us, Ruben.
Thank you.
What are ICTJ's main recommendations to the ICC on reparations in this case?
Our submission proposes to the court that it acknowledge all victims of violations, even if only a smaller number of victims of the crime itself can be offered material reparations. We also propose that the court provide victims, their families, communities of victims, the opportunity to be heard and to participate in the process of determining what the most feasible and meaningful forms of reparations are. So within that proposal, for example, we've suggested that the court hold a hearing on reparations in the DRC if it decides to proceed to a reparations hearing. We've also proposed that the court authorize multiple and longer periods in which victims can register and apply for reparations. And we've proposed that the court conduct a mapping of the location, the circumstances, and the needs of the most vulnerable victims. On top of these recommendations, we've proposed that the court consider a combination of individual reparations measures as well as community-based reparations measures. For the individual measures, we've suggested compensation for the direct victims of the crime, in other words, the victims of forced recruitment. That's the crime for which Thomas Lubanga was convicted. We've also suggested specialized medical care for those same persons, financial assistance toward completing their education or so that they can acquire income-generating skills. We've also suggested that the court consider awarding additional compensation for victims of forced recruitment who were also victims of sexual violence and who may have had children born out of the sexual violence they experienced. And then with respect again to individual victims of the crime, we've suggested that the court ask for the cooperation of the government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the DRC, so that the DRC government can issue government documents stating that a former child soldier should not be held legally responsible for acts committed as a child soldier during the conflict. This is of course different from community-based material and symbolic reparations that we think are important, especially in the situation in the Congo where the perception of communities is that the victims of forced recruitment belong to one community, the community of Thomas Lubanga, while on the other hand, the victims of the violence that were committed, whether by the child soldiers of Lubanga or other armed actors, were from other communities. So community-based reparations need to take into account these differences of impact among communities.
As you mentioned, in asking for these submissions, the ICC has asked for advice on whether reparations should be individual or collective, which experts to consult, what principles to follow in ordering reparations, and other questions. But it seems the key issue will be whether the funds or where the funds for the reparations come from. What options can judges consider, and where, in your opinion, does the ultimate responsibility for reparations to victims rest? With the state, the convicted individual, or a special fund set up by international funders?
Under the Rome Statute, the ICC can order and award reparations against the perpetrator directly or through the Trust Fund for Victims, or the TFV. The TFV is a separate institution under the Rome Statute, purposely created to implement reparations orders from the ICC, from the court. The Lubanga case presents a challenge to the reparations mandate of the court, not only because of the narrow set of crimes that the prosecutor charged in the case, which implies that there will only be a small set of direct victims, but also because the convicted person, Thomas Lubanga, has no assets from which reparations can be paid for. The court ordered an investigation into the assets of Lubanga, but no assets have been found so far. What will likely happen here is that the assets of the Trust Fund for Victims will be the principal source of funding for reparations in the Tomas Lubanga case. The state itself, the DRC, will not be responsible for reparations through this process because the ICC has no jurisdiction over states.
Can you expand a bit on the question of who is entitled to reparations? As you mentioned, in this case, there are 79 victims who were participated in the case and applied for reparations, but this is arguably a fraction of those who suffered at the hand of Lubanga and or his orders. What claim do these victims have to reparations, either from the state or the verdict, and how should these claims be met?
It's important to remember that the right to reparations of victims of violations, in this case the victims of the crimes, are victims of human rights violations as well. It's important to remember that the right to reparations exists independently of the Rome Statute. In other words, victims of human rights violations have a right to obtain reparations even without a criminal conviction, even if the identity of the perpetrator is unknown, even if the perpetrator has not been arrested, tried, or convicted. The ICC has a limited mandate to award reparations and can only award reparations to those who apply for it. In this case, as you mentioned, 79 persons applied so far. The ICC can, of course, open up registration, expand the outreach programs of the court so that more victims who are qualified can apply for reparations. But in the end, many of the victims of the violence and the conflict that is connected to the activities of Lubanga and to the armed groups involved in this case will not be entitled to reparations from the ICC. That doesn't mean, however, that they cannot obtain reparations either from the perpetrator or from the state, the DRC. But to obtain reparations from the state, in this case the DRC, it will be important to show that the violations that the victims suffered were a result either of the commission of violations by agents of the state or by violations that the state could have prevented. And so there are other considerations beyond the conviction of Lubanga when looking at the entitlement to reparations of victims.
All this draws the question, are courts the best mechanisms for awarding reparations in cases of massive human rights violations? Or will non-judicial institutions, such as truth commissions or state administrative agencies established to manage reparations programs, can be more effective and comprehensive at providing reparations?
The limitation of having criminal courts award reparations will become clearer once the court in Lubanga decides to move forward and determine whether it should award reparations. We already saw part of that limitation in the narrow set of charges that were made against Tomas Lubanga. We will see that once the court decides to award reparations and determines that only a relatively small number of victims can in fact be entitled to reparations. While it's important and I think meaningful that the ICC has a reparations mandate, it's also important to acknowledge the limitation of that mandate. And what the court can probably do in acknowledging that limitation is to precisely say so in any order on reparations it may issue in Lubanga. The court can in fact acknowledge that limitation and mention the fact that states may have the responsibility as well to award and establish reparations programs so that a larger universe of victims can be provided reparations. The other possibility that the court can explore is to use some of its powers, including its power to ask states to cooperate with it so that some form of reparations other than compensation can be given to victims. For instance, under Article 93 of the Rome Statute, the court can ask for cooperation from states so that documents involving violations, the sites where violations took place, the truth about violations, including, for instance, disappearances and killings, can be archived, can be documented, and can be made available to victims. In other words, there are various forms of reparative justice that the court can also explore that's possible within its mandate. But ultimately, it will be more important to explore mechanisms of transitional justice that can be linked to reparations. In other countries, truth commissions have recommended reparations for victims. In other contexts, states have established administrative reparations programs that look at different categories of victims and provide reparations that respond specifically to the violations that victims suffered. And it is in these mechanisms, I think, that there can be more comprehensive, more meaningful, and in the end, more feasible forms of reparations that can be given to victims.
Are there past experiences of national courts or ad hoc tribunals that can provide lessons learned to ICC judges to be considered in this case?
This case involves forced recruitment, and there have been a few cases only in which either national courts with a mandate to try and prosecute forced recruitment or ad hoc tribunals that can try and prosecute forced recruitment have made rulings on that crime. But there have been significant rulings as well that the court can take into account. One is a recent ruling in Colombia under the Peace and Justice Law, the case of El Alemán, involving a paramilitary leader accused and convicted of forcibly recruiting children into his paramilitary group. The judge in Bogota of the court with a mandate under the Peace and Justice Law, in fact, awarded some forms of reparations against El Alemán, considered the question of compensation for children who were recruited, as well as compensation to their families. The court considered rehabilitation measures that could be given to the children. And the court in Colombia even considered whether the prosecutor in Colombia should investigate corporations who had been funding the paramilitary group of El Alemán, including his activities involving forced recruitment. It's a 2011 decision that the court can look at, and it has very important implications on measuring compensation, on determining the appropriate forms of rehabilitation for children who were victims of forced recruitment, and on distributing compensation among families and communities affected by forced recruitment. One of the more salient aspects of the El Alemán ruling has been whether the perpetrator can offer memorialization measures that the court can consider. And in El Alemán, the court in fact rejected an offer by El Alemán, the convicted person, to fund memorials because the court said that doing that might in fact reinforce El Alemán's role in the lives of the children and continue to propagate the idea that he is a leader of the children he recruited. The other case that is in contrast to that and shows how jurisprudence on forced recruitment and the possibilities of reparations in forced recruitment has developed is an older case, the 2008 case involving the AFRC paramilitary group in Sierra Leone, whose leaders were prosecuted and convicted by the Special Court of Sierra Leone in 2008. In that case, because the Special Court of Sierra Leone has no mandate to award reparations, even if the court convicted and sentenced the leaders of the paramilitary group to several years of imprisonment, the court could not award reparations. At the same time, there was a Truth Commission in Sierra Leone that had recommended reparations, including reparations for children. But in the end, the government of Sierra Leone only had a limited amount of money by which to fund reparations. And in the end, only a small number of children benefited from reparations through the reparations program established by the government of Sierra Leone. These were children who were disabled as a result of the conflict, not children who were forcibly recruited or who were necessarily forcibly recruited by the paramilitary groups or armed groups involved in the conflict in Sierra Leone. So you can see the contrast here between a court that had a mandate to award reparations in Colombia and now the ICC, and a court several years earlier that had no mandate to award reparations But in the end, victims had to rely on a truth commission and a reparations program in order to receive a limited range of reparations.
Lastly, what do you see as potential impact of the ruling on reparations in the Lubanga case on national courts grappling with issues of reparations in similar cases?
I think one of the most important consequences that might grow out of any reparations order in Lubanga is the strengthening of the recognition of the right to reparations of victims. That's important because reparations has been one of the most neglected aspects of not just transitional justice, but of providing redress for victims of human rights violations in general. The second important possible consequence would be to strengthen the capacity of governments, including national courts or state agencies, to provide reparations. That will be strengthened even by showing the limitation of the ICC's capacity to provide reparations. In other words, if the ICC can make explicit that problem of not being able to provide reparations for most victims, and at the same time show the way so that governments can act on the right to reparations directly, then I think it will be an important contribution to recognizing the right of victims to reparations.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Ruben. More information about the work of ICTJ can be found online at ictj.org. Thanks once again.